For the next few mornings, we're going to be talking about American lives. We'll hear about the life stories of a business tycoon, a sports hero, and this morning, one of the best-loved writers in American literature. For many, Louisa May Alcott is synonymous with her most famous character, Jo March, the spirited sister in the Alcott classic Little Women. And while the real Louisa and the fictitious Jo do have many things in common, in fact, their lives are very different. The real life of Louisa May Alcott is the subject of the newest American Masters, premiering on PBS tonight. Harriet Rison wrote and produced the film, and she joins us from our studio in New York. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
We so identify the March family in Little Women with the Alcotts. Basically, you make the point in the program that a lot of this was marketing.
Yes, I think Louisa made herself a brand called The Children's Friend, and she suppressed the fact that she had written pulp fiction that included stories about spies and transvestites and drug takers, and that her own life was very atypical.
She really did grow up in an extraordinary political atmosphere. Her father, a very free-thinking educator, he and the family were friends with some of the most famous people of their day. What is it about this man, Bronson Alcott, that he was so attractive to so many people and yet somehow never quite managed to earn a living and take care of his family?
Well, as Louisa put it, he was a man in a balloon with his family holding the ropes, trying to hold him down to earth. He seemed to live on air and in the air and had no concern about earning a living. And it didn't seem to bother him that his family was literally starving.
At the same time, people like Ralph Waldo Emerson thought he referred to him as a demigod. His friends were Hawthorne and Thoreau and Longfellow. And what a peculiar man he must have been.
Well, he was an idealist ahead of his time, and people like Emerson saw that. So he guided himself by his own stars. And he was interesting in that Bronson Alcott explored Eastern religions, and actually towards the end of her life, Louisa May Alcott confessed that she believed in reincarnation. So she's not the little woman, and you thought she was, and her life was no children's book.
One of the big differences, of course, in the real life and the children's book is economic. The March family and Little Women were not wealthy. They lived in genteel poverty. The real Alcott family lived in serious, grinding, horrible poverty, in real need. I mean, they went hungry.
That's right. They really ate bread and water for stretches. She was hungry, and she worked to rescue her family from poverty. And part of her story is a real Horatio Alger rags-to-riches tale.
We're going to play a little clip from the documentary. This is Elizabeth Marvel, who plays Louisa Alcott. She has been reading her diaries, the diaries that she wrote when she was a little child, and she's talking about the impact of being very poor.
Little Lou began early to feel the family cares and peculiar trials. I never forgot this experience. My little cross began to grow heavier from this hour.
So from the time she was a little kid, she began to vow a mighty vow that she was going to see to it that her family didn't have to be poor.
That's right. She said, I wish I was rich, I was good, and we were all a happy family this day. And she just turned 11 when she wrote that.
But, you know, the impression that you have in Little Women, I mean, the sort of the high-mindedness, it's just a huge contrast with what really drove Louisa May Alcott, and not in a good way, which was being very poor.
That's right. She said, money is the means and end of my mercenary existence. And she wrote what she called moral pap for the young because it pays well.
Now, what about the book Hospital Sketches? That was a collection of letters that she wrote when she was a nurse in a Civil War hospital here in Washington. That was, according to your documentary, a breakthrough book. Why was that?
It was a breakthrough because she wrote from what she knew. She had been writing flower fables, children's stories, and sentimental stories for story papers, for shop girls that were really based on her reading. Hospital Sketches was based on this dreadful but fascinating experience she had as a nurse in the Civil War hospital in the aftermath of the bloody Battle of Fredericksburg.
One of the most interesting things that Bronson Alcott says in the film you have, he said about her when she went off to do the stint of nursing in Washington, that he's sending his only son to war.
Louisa actually wound up having to be not only the breadwinner and take that classically male role, but when her younger sister died, she took the role of the daughter who doesn't marry and who takes care of the aged parents.
But she was, in many ways, wasn't she, a feminist? I mean, remaining unmarried, earning money and so forth, she was in control of her situation.
Well, that was very much part of it. She saw her mother really dependent on this improvident husband, and she saw the position of most married women who she felt were marrying as an economic solution, and she said, I'd rather be a free spinster and paddle my own canoe. And she said, and I love luxury, but freedom and independence better.
What do you think is the legacy of Louisa May Alcott, the kind of sweetness of Little Women or something else?
Oh, I think it's something else. I think it's really empowerment of women and girls around the world. And since the time Little Women was published in 1868, I came across a comment from a Korean woman who said, you don't grow up to walk two steps behind your husband when you've met Joe March. The number of women who say that they believe that they could do something, they could take fate by the throat and shake a living out of it, as another thing that she says. Because Joe March was a very flawed, passionate character who did not always do right and made lots of mistakes and succeeded and drove herself and didn't pay attention to the things girls weren't supposed to do. So I really do think that's her legacy.
Harriet Rison wrote and produced the film on the real life of Louisa May Alcott, which is the newest American Masters. That's on PBS tonight. Harriet Rison, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can watch scenes from The Woman Behind Little Women on our website at npr.org. Tomorrow, the life of America's first tycoon, Cornelius Vanderbilt. This is NPR News.
Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, Steven Spielberg. None of these fine directors will be mentioned in this next segment because today our film critic Bob Mondello and I will be talking about the worst films of the decade. And Bob, I know you've been looking forward to this one.
Actually, I kind of have, but remember, I'm a sweetheart. Okay. I am a total sweetheart.
Bob's been coming in on the program all month to look back at the last 10 years in film. And Bob, let's set some ground rules here. There are plenty of bad films that go to DVD right away, but we're not going to talk about those, right?
That's right. What I think we should do is talk about films that have burned enough people so that it's fair to talk about them. So let's say that it has to have hit at least 4 million people,
okay,
which at $750 a pop would be about $30 million. But however, that makes me not talk about one picture that I'd really like to mention for a second, The Hottie and the Naughty. The Hottie and the Naughty starred Paris Hilton. It made $27,000 in the United States, all right? However, I looked in boxofficemojo.com, and it made $1.5 million, and I thought, where did it make it if it didn't make it in the United States? It made it in Russia. So we did win the Cold War.
Paris Hilton in Russia. God bless him. Bob, let's start with worst romance.
All right. I considered Gigli, the Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez specialty, The public somehow knew about that, and they didn't go to it. On the other hand, they did go to the Matthew McConaughey picture, Fool's Gold. It was enough to put me off the whole genre. Matthew McConaughey and Kate Hudson.
Who else?
Exactly. They were a recently divorced couple searching for hidden treasure. They're spitting venom at each other through most of this film.
If we don't go after that treasure, it's going to haunt us the rest of our lives, and you know it. You really think I'd lie about this?
Why not? You're a liar.
I mean, this is such an inappropriate time to dwell on that.
Bob, this is so painful.
It was. They were amazingly bad. And, you know, it was clear that they had complete contempt for the material. And Matthew McConaughey, if I never see him again, it'll be too soon.
Ouch, ouch.
Well, you know, he'll eventually make a good movie. The thing is that at one point, he showed some promise. He was making serious pictures.
Yeah, he was in Richard Linklater films.
Right. And then it all just sort of went away. And he's decided to make these silly comedies. And now it's a little embarrassing. He's at least pushing 40, and he's still acting like a teenager, and it's awful.
All right, the next movie is a familiar punching bag for a lot of critics. I don't know if it's entirely fair, but I guess we have to talk about the worst science fiction film of the decade, and it is...
Battlefield Earth. It's kind of a walk, too. John Travolta's salute to the sci-fi writing of Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard. It was released in 2000, and Elvis Mitchell, writing in the New York Times at the time, said, and I quote, "It may be a bit early to make such judgments, but Battlefield Earth may turn out to be the worst movie of the century." How about that? The year is 3000 in this picture. Aliens, who are called Cyclos, have defeated Earth in a war that lasted 9 minutes and basically exterminated the planet and are now using humans as slave labor to strip the planet. And John Travolta is Turl, their leader.
As long as you were providing me with useful information, I wouldn't file the report. But now that I'm leaving this pitiful excuse for a planet, you will no longer be providing me with useful information, will you?
I'm begging you. My son just got accepted into the academy. First one ever in my family. You know how much it costs. Please, as a friend, couldn't you forget to file the report?
Well, as a friend, I could forget to file the report. But unfortunately, I'm not your friend!
And
now, that laugh was constant in this picture, and you just wanted to die while you were watching it. It was,
I wonder if this film could have another life as sort of a cult classic film, watched by sort of college kids.
Yeah, the problem is it was long and just sort of exhausting, and it's really dark, and it isn't fun. You wanted it to be fun, and it's just terrible.
All right, let's move on to the worst blockbuster of the decade. This one was directed by Michael Bay, who, as you know, Bob, has never met an explosion he could not make bigger and noisier.
Pearl Harbor did make plenty of money, though. It raked in about $450 million worldwide. Now, how do I explain why this picture doesn't work? The actual attack on Pearl Harbor lasted 90 minutes. This movie is 3 hours, okay? Just for starters. Wikipedia lists 65 historical inaccuracies in the picture. This movie had Ben Affleck taking flight lessons on Long Island with mountains in the background. There were lots of really terrible blockbusters this decade, but usually they have something in them that is somehow redeeming. 30 minutes of blowing up Pearl Harbor, shot the way Michael Bay shoots it so that you can't actually tell what's going on at any given moment, isn't really a redeeming feature.
And now the moment we've all been waiting for. Bob Mondello's worst film of the decade. Bob, the worst film of the decade is?
Well, certainly the most annoying one is Mike Myers' The Love Guru.
Oh.
Is he Mr. Right or Mr. Right Now?
Rajneesh, let's make like a baby and head out.
The Love Guru is the story of a very needy guru who is played by what seems to be a very needy Mike Myers, who is hired to motivate the Toronto Maple Leafs.
They're the hockey team.
His methods include lewd self-help mantras, elephant erotica, and an endless supply of jokes about male endowment.
Damn.
Looks like he's smuggling a schnauzer.
It was so bad. It was coarse and unpleasant. Mike Myers is so full of himself in the picture. I mean, he's almost winking at the camera. He is smirking at his own jokes. He makes you want to throttle him. Listen.
You're breaking out in hives in the studio. But you did sit through every last minute of all of these movies we've been talking about. You're pretty resilient, Bob.
Yeah, I guess. I've still got the best job in the world. I see an awful lot more movies than most people, though, and a lot of them are not, shall we say, of the first water.
That's our film critic, Bob Mondello. He's been dropping by all month to talk about the decade gone by in the film world. Bob, thank you so much.
It's been a lot of fun.
And I know those of you listening are dying to tell us your most hated films of the decade. Join the conversation at npr.org. And while you're there, check out the Arts Podcast. Bob's got more about the movies and theaters now. That's at npr.org/movies.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today in Your Health, Protecting Young Athletes. This January, the National Collegiate Athletic Association is expected to decide whether universities have to test athletes for the sickle cell trait. That's an inherited gene, not a disease. It's found most often in African Americans. Having one sickle cell gene has been linked to the death of several young athletes, mainly football players. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
Bridget Lloyd says that her 19-year-old son had been an athlete all his life, excelling in football and baseball, before he was offered an athletic scholarship to Rice University.
Dell was a gift from God, truly, and I always would instill in him that, son, you know, you are truly blessed, not only athletically, but academically. And he say, Mom, you know, you're right.
He always gave 110%, she says. So one hot day in late September 2006, after a bruising defeat the day before, the 190-pound freshman defensive back headed to the university stadium for a light workout.
The light workout turned to a little bit more strenuous workout, and they did weightlifting and a lot of running. And during the running portion, he collapsed. And he passed away the following day.
When she and her husband, Dale Lloyd Jr., arrived at the hospital, they were met by doctors who were initially baffled by his condition. Late into the night, they asked if he had the sickle cell trait. It turns out he did. Dale had inherited the gene from his father. Sickle cell disease can be extremely debilitating, but the trait is benign in most circumstances. It never occurred to Dale's parents to have him tested.
We would always look for to make sure he has a good heart, because they always say, you know, that young people get out there and work out, and sometimes their hearts give out with the strenuous workout. So we always had him checked out from top to bottom.
The cause of death was a condition associated with sickle cell trait, the flat red blood cell sickle starving tissues of oxygen. Muscles break down, releasing toxins. It's brought on by extreme exertion, hot climate, and high altitudes. Until recently, most coaches and trainers were ignorant of the problem, says Scott Anderson, director of athletic training for the University of Oklahoma. He became aware of it about 14 years ago when one of his players collapsed.
The physicians at the hospital recognized that he had sickle cell trait, but they said that's not what his problem is.
The athlete survived, but Anderson investigated and found that his collapse was similar to others that had not ended so well.
Deaths were occurring, and even as deaths occurred, those cases and events were not communicated to the profession as a whole.
He started requiring athletes at the University of Oklahoma to be screened and urged members of the National Association of Athletic Trainers to recommend screening to all colleges. In 2007, they did.
Doesn't matter whether they're playing football or another sport. Doesn't matter if they're a male athlete or a female athlete. It doesn't matter, you know, if they're African American or Caucasian or Native American or whatever.
Up to 20 athletes at Oklahoma have been found to have the sickle cell trait. Not all were African American. In a culture of sport known for pushing athletes to the breaking point, Anderson says he educates players to set limits.
If they're experiencing undue fatigue, shortness of breath, a sensation of lower extremity, low back cramping, spasm, we want them to report those symptoms immediately.
An athlete would then be withdrawn from training and allowed to recover. The point is not to exclude anyone from sports, he says, pointing out that in the National Football League, it's estimated that 7% of the players have the sickle cell trait. That includes athletes like Curtis Lofton, Oklahoma's All-American linebacker, who now plays for the Atlanta Falcons. Bridget Lloyd didn't know all this until 2006 when her son died, but she says the NCAA did.
You go and look on the internet, you will find names and names and names of young people who should have had a young and productive lives that were cut short because the NCAA didn't inform them that this situation could affect your health.
So the family sued the NCAA. As part of a settlement, the organization agreed to recommend that universities and colleges offer to screen all athletes. But Dr. Elliot Vichinsky, a hematologist at Children's Hospital Oakland, worries that the policy hasn't been thought through.
If you just have a willy-nilly go get tested and then go see somebody for counseling, while it is not mandatory, there's a tremendous medical legal pressure on them to do this. Why would I put a trait person out to play on Sunday when it's really hot? I may be liable.
In the past, African Americans were blocked from military service and certain kinds of employment if they carried the trait. Though 64% of colleges now screen for trait, it's no guarantee of safety. The University of Central Florida screened Eric Plancher, a young freshman defensive player, for the sickle cell trait. He died during strenuous training. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
The supervolcano beneath Yellowstone National Park is bigger, much bigger, than scientists had previously thought. A team of researchers found that the plume of hot and molten rock that feeds the volcano rises from a depth of more than 400 miles below the Earth's surface. And the reservoir that holds that molten rock, well, it's 20% larger than we once knew. University of Utah geophysicist Robert Smith led that team and joins us from member station KUER in Salt Lake City. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Can you put this supervolcano into a perspective for us? I mean, how have its past eruptions compared to, you know, a volcano like Mount St. Helens?
Well, recall that Yellowstone National Park, of course, is the quintessential geology park with hot springs and geysers, and they derive their heat from magma from an active volcanic system that has been in the Yellowstone area active for about 2 million years. In the 2 million year span, there's been three giant eruptions, and these, you know, occurred 2 million years, 1.3 million, and 640,000 years ago. And in between these eruptions and since the last one, there's been smaller eruptions, many much bigger than those of Mount St. Helens.
Now, Professor Smith, presumably you and your team could not start digging underground to find this magma chamber and actually measure it because you wouldn't be speaking to us now. How did you actually figure this out?
Well, we use a method called seismic tomography, which is similar to a CAT scan of a human body. And we measure the speed of earthquake-produced waves that propagate through the Earth, and we record them on a large array of seismographs at the surface. And when a seismic wave, just like a sound wave I'm talking to you, is a seismic wave, if it's speeded up or slowed down by the rock material, and hot rock produces generally lower speeds of sound than cold rocks. And so what we then do is record, you know, literally thousands of earthquakes and do a computer reconstruction of where they were slowed down or speeded up. And from that, we can construct an image. We're illuminating a body just like turning on a light or like taking a CAT scan or an X-ray.
Now, there are two components to this, right? I mean, there's the magma chamber, which is 20% larger, but then there's this volcanic plume that is about 400 miles below the Earth's surface, below the town of Wisdom, Montana, which is, what, about 100 miles from Yellowstone?
Yeah, that discovery we've made in the sense that most people had originally implied that plumes in the earth, they're just vertical features like boiling water in a teapot. And what we found is, in fact, it's tilted because the earth's mantle is moving at a few centimeters per year. And it's tilted because the hot material is caught in the wind of the mantle. I like to use the analogy. You see smoke rising, and when it gets into a breeze, it gets slightly tilted by the breeze. Well, that's what's happening in the Earth's mantle beneath the Yellowstone area.
So any reaction from the folks in Wisdom, Montana? I mean, are they sort of preparing to become a vacation destination in the next million years or so?
I'm not sure that they've heard my story lately, but I doubt that they're too concerned about that. Nothing at that depth is going to have any effect on the surface of the Earth there at all.
That's Robert Smith. He's a research professor at the University of Utah. His findings on Yellowstone's supervolcano appear in the Journal of Volcanology and Geothermal Research. Robert Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.